Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Radio Plays, the interview sessions. My name is Sean M. Dale, and I played both the director and Harrison in Trey's broadcast.
And I'm Anna Fontaine. I had the joy of listening to this episode, and I'm a company member and actor here at Radio Plays.
And today we have Leotis Smith IV hanging out with us, man. How you doing, Leo?
I am doing great. Just got my second vaccine today, so.
Nice.
Not feeling it yet, but we'll see.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be mellow to you.
Yeah, you know what you should do? Just go out and just do a bunch of stuff. Don't even just be as active as you possibly can. Exactly. Yeah. Don't think about it. And then the day will pass and you'll be like, you know what? It's a pretty smooth ride.
And yeah, that's my plan. Any day I wake up and don't feel anything, I'm going to go jogging or something.
Yep.
That's
right. Just kind of be as normal as possible, yeah.
So Leo is the writer of Trey's broadcast. So I'll just start throwing questions at you, Leo, and we'll get right to it, man.
Let's bring them.
So what has been your path to playwriting?
Well, it started with writing short stories when I was 12 because my mom saw me and my sister one summer, and we were always playing like baseball with vacuum cleaner parts. And the problem was that I was always putting dents in walls because the parts would fly off. Not because I was intentionally trying to smash the walls, but you know, the parts fly off because they're only so reliable as a bat. And then she was like, okay, y'all gotta do something with that energy. So she would like make us write short stories and whatnot. And like my sister never fully committed to it, but I was like, I had something to write every day. Because then it just kind of became that thing of like, ooh, I really want to do this. And I already wanted to be an actor at this point in time. So it was kind of like, I should probably do this in addition to acting. Like, nice. Definitely, like, help myself out a little bit. And from there, you know, I started doing theater in high school. And I actually started seeing plays and whatnot. And I was like, oh, yeah, I want to write those. I want to do that. That would absolutely be something fun to do.
Yeah.
And so I just added plays to stuff I wanted to write. And, you know, I decided that that was something I wanted to do in my professional life. And so I just have been doing that. Writing plays and acting. Sometimes doing both, if you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like everybody is multi-hyphenate in our field.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I've definitely noticed that a lot more. Because it used to, you know, I used to be of the mindset like, hey, don't be the guy who's like in their own work all the time. And now it's like, okay, if you want a job and you want an acting job right now, you need to be in your work right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything, it's more opportunities for like you to explore. While you can audition for a bunch of other things, you can also be in something that you wrote and you're passionate about, which is awesome.
Yeah.
So as a playwright, as a writer, what is it that typically inspires you when it comes to the plays that you write? Like, is it kind of prompts, or is it just like people watching, music, news articles? What kind of gets your brain going and creating new plays?
I'm somewhere between news articles and music, usually, or just random thoughts that invade my head and then decide to be like, oh, this is what we want to talk about. Well, how do we want to talk about this? Well, let's see.
Cool.
And I noticed that, you know, specifically with Trey's broadcast, you know, it's a family drama, you know, but it's also connected to like national issues that are going on right now. And coincidentally, we did this play a year ago. So to see that it's still something that we're talking about to this day, I mean, it's going to have some serious relevance. So what inspired you to write this particular play?
Well, last Memorial Day, or otherwise known as the worst Memorial Day for black folks in a bit, happened. And it was just like, four different incidents happened in the same day. Initially, I started out the lockdown like thinking to myself, I'm going to work on this one full-length play I have, and I'm just going to chill. I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to try to do anything. I'm just going to chill and write this play and wait for everything to open back up. No matter how long it takes, that's what I'm going to do. And just right when I heard that, I was like, well, I can't not say anything about this. I can't not respond to it. I'm too mad not to respond to it. And so I had ended up writing this, but I didn't want to write something that was going to be a conversation between like a black person who was angry about this thing and a white cop who kills a black person. Like, I didn't want it to be that because I felt like there was already that information out there. And it was kind of at a point where I was kept trying to figure out, like, how do I want to write this? How do I want to write this? Can it be that? And each time it came out to that I would try to do it where it was like, oh, you know, it's, you know, black protester and a white cop having this conversation who might be like friends or something. It just never registered in my brain. Like, there was just always a disconnect. And then at some point, you know, there was a video actually of this one cop who, you know, it's the one where she sees the one guy in her officer squad unit who is attempting to, like, pushes a protester, and he's already, like, greeting her with hostility, and the protester hasn't done anything to him yet, and she just straight up comes out and starts, you know, just getting all up in his face, like, hey, don't do any of that, and just takes him, and, like, and it's that one moment where I thought, well, there are black cops who definitely are dealing with this and who are somewhere in between as well, you know, who have this problem where they're in between, like, they see the protest and they understand why it's happening and they know where we are, but they also, unfortunately, they're cops too. And so they have to just kind of, like, navigate both of these things. And I figure, like, that is the story I want to write. The one where it is these two brothers who are on the opposite side of this thing, where they're having to have a conversation that they've probably had multiple times at this point about who's on what side of what of this issue, especially because I had seen a USA Today article. I don't know if you remember, Sean, I sent you this while we were doing it, and it was the one where the guy was talking about how he was this one black cop, and he was also talking to protesters about just how often they would tell him, like, you're on the wrong side, sir.
I thought it was interesting, actually, kind of going back, the traumatic loss that these two characters share as brothers with their mother, and how that kind of made its way into the central part of their storyline. How did that come about as part of their relationship?
I think there was a story I had read about the daughter of Eric Garner at one point and how she had basically been protesting, like, the entire time, just trying to get justice for, like, her dad, and how she had basically, I think, died while protesting for her dad. I thought about that and just the nature of the fact that, you know, there's this one person over here who's protesting and who got involved in this movement because they see their dad, and there's that part of my brain of, like, okay, what if someone also ended up joining the force for some reason, the police force, because of the same reason, and they decided that they could change it from the inside? Because Lord knows I've heard plenty of things. I remember seeing this one post go viral in 2016 that people were hellbent on sharing about, like, instead of protesting and being on the streets, why don't you go inside the system and change it? And it was always this one from this one black police captain in Dallas. And it always kind of registered as, like, I get where you're coming from, but you have to realize the people who are unfortunately wanting to tout your points don't care about helping things from the inside. The people who are touting your points are people who want things to stay the same. And you have to realize you're doing some of these racist jobs for them. And that's where that came from.
Well, kind of speaking of that, there is a line in the play, and this, I think you can maybe both discuss it as actors and then also as the writer. There's a line, you know, doing the work of evil people, which popped out to me. So first for Sean, how do you think he views his work, and who do you think he thinks he is working for?
Yeah, I think that speaks a little bit to what Leo just said. Harrison has convinced himself that he is working for change from the inside out. Even though it may be particularly controversial within his community to work for an institution that's so mistrusted, it's definitely put him in a position where he's like, you know what? No, I can navigate these waters. Even though it's controversial, I'm going to help my people. I'm going to save. He's kind of got that, like, hero complex where he's like, I can save my people through this and in this way. question.
Yeah, and I mean, from Trey's perspective, who does he view the evil people that his brother is working for? Like, who are those people, and how? It's discussed in the play, but I'm just curious the specifics behind Trey's point of view on that.
I would say it's just these people who, you know, it's these rich property owners. It's all these people who they'll run a protester down the street in their car. These government lawmakers in these states who want to make it harder for people to protest. I think that's what Trey sees when he thinks about his brother working for the force. He sees those people.
So he sees him more at the idea of like, okay, well, you're enforcing laws that are racist, as opposed to if you are going to, like, quote unquote, work from the inside. I mean, what would Trey want his brother to do instead? Would it be like, well, be the one who's making the laws, or would it be a part of the protest? And in Trey's point of view, if Harrison is a police officer, is that kind of, no matter what he does, he's still not, they're still going to be on opposite sides? Like, there's no way to do anything positive from that job and from Trey's point of view?
I would say that's what it is at this point, because for Trey, there's a lot of, he goes, he marches, he works with this particular organization, and as far as he is concerned, there are a whole lot of other things his brother could do other than work for the cops, who have no intent on changing. Like, in his mind, he feels like the cops have no intention of doing better, and that even if his brother does believe that, you know, he's gonna do the work to do well from the inside, I think there's that thing in his mind where, you know, he thinks, well, you're not the only cop on the force, are you? You know, you're still outnumbered by a bunch of people who won't do the right thing when the time comes.
So he has to do a lot of work to change, like, a culture in Trey's, or mentality, yeah, within that.
Yeah, it's just, I think, ideology for Trey, where it's kind of like, even if you go inside with the intent of trying to change things, he has that feeling like, well, you're not going to change it. At worst, and at best, it's going to change you, and hopefully you're able to minimize the damage when it does.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting, too, like, as a listener, and maybe you can both kind of speak to this as, again, as actors and as the writer. Like, Harrison, I saw go experience a lot of conflicts and a lot of, like, he's, you know, Trey challenged him and made him think. And so Harrison was kind of making a lot of discoveries. And kind of, as you mentioned, Trey, kind of where he was, he seemed very, very fixed on his point. And so that kind of, for me listening, it made him a little bit more of a static character, like he was already kind of there. But it's interesting because you brought up the idea of wanting to maybe see his brother's side, but kind of struggling with it. Can you discuss the internal conflict that Trey is experiencing? Because we see a lot of Harrison's conflict in their discussion. But what's Trey's internal conflict?
I would say that Trey's internal conflict is just reckoning with the fact that his brother is who his brother is, and that he is trying to understand what he's doing. But his, like, other thing is that it's like, you're trying to work with people, and I get that, but it's that he sees that badge that his brother wears, and it's just like, it is just that instant raging bull that comes out of, like, but you work for those people. And it's just, okay, maybe I get it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe possibly. I don't get what's happening.
Yeah. Because again, like, listening, I think Trey made the point to Harrison, because Harrison talked about, like, progress, like making progress. But he was kind of vague about it. And then Trey was like, those are vague. And I'm curious, as you, like, continue with this play, and there's more to even talk about now, and as just lots of things develop continuously. Mm-hmm. But how that, maybe by giving Harrison specific arguments, so making his point of view less vague of like, hey, well, here's this progress, and here's this thing, and here's this thing, would that bring Trey's kind of inner conflict of, all right, you might be right about this, a little bit more to the fore, but still, it might not change. They might still, Trey still probably may feel the same way. But do you think, is if you were to, like, keep developing the story, would that be maybe a way to, like, bring that internal conflict for Trey and see his kind of arc as a character develop even more?
Definitely, because the way I see Trey is very much he has developed a very clear burn it all down way of thinking.
Mm.
And for me, it's very much that Harrison is representative of a way I like to write that is very much, I believe I am doing the right thing. I'm just not exactly sure that other people can see I'm doing the right thing because I very clearly, on the outside, am not doing the right thing. But I am confident in it anyway. I would say, well, it's titled Trey's Broadcast. It's very much Harrison's particular type of thing because it's definitely me trying to understand what goes on. And it's my way of both being angry and also being like, look, I understand that the job is difficult. I do. But it's very clear that you believe you're doing the other when the evidence to the contrary is telling you it's not happening that way.
Mm-hmm. So as a writer, is that something that you use as a tool to have these conversations with your own opinions and stuff? Do you write a character and then you're like, you know, as you're exploring the depth of that role, write a character that's contrasting that helps you kind of talk through some of your own?
Absolutely. I definitely believe that it's really easy to go and be the protagonist of your own story and to say, like, that person, see, they're wrong all the time. And it's really easy to pick an easy target and to have a gunfire for you and just do the easy thing. I am very much not interested in doing that because I feel like there's a lot of complexity that gets lost when you do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's also a lot of truth that gets lost when you do that. And so for me, I write very much the intention of both interrogating my own beliefs and also interrogating my own role in participating in said problems. Like, if there's a lot of, well, how do I help this? Or how do I hurt this? Or how am I not making the situation better? How am I not presenting a solution? Or how is the solution I'm presenting actively causing more harm than good in that scenario? Because, like I said, I think it's really easy to be the good guy when you are making your own stuff, but it's really hard to say, nah, here's some areas where I may be messing up.
Yeah, so like having those two, like you were saying, Sean, like having those two characters who have, see, maybe at first really hard blanket opinions of like, well, you're wrong because of this, well, you're wrong because of this, but then in the midst of that breaking it down and each of them kind of understanding a little bit more the nuance of the other. Is that often how you write?
Yes. Also because I just think about the fact that it's like, well, someone else has to be in rehearsal to play this character, and I definitely you definitely don't want someone in rehearsal like, oh man, they did not give me jack to do. Like, they aren't trying to help me at all. Like,
right. Going back to your writing style again, do you have particular genres that you're drawn to as a writer?
I tend to like sci-fi, fantasy, comedy type stuff.
Oh.
Like, this is the most normal thing I've written.
Yeah, so like you had mentioned, you know, you typically write a lot of actually sci-fi and comedic stuff, and this is a kind of topical thing. So is that, how was that experience for you, writing that?
It's been different, because currently most of the plays I've written are about what I like to call people discovering how to be human, which is, I think, plays that I have started writing because I am so used to feeling not native to where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just because I've moved a lot, so most of the plays I've written are, most of the things I write tend to be from the perspective of otherworldly beings or mythical beings, because I'm like, yeah, that's where I am in this entire conversation. That's where I fit. And so this in particular was, I think, the first time where I just kind of immediately took in what was happening around me and decided to just go, no, I'm not going to write this in any metaphor. I'm not going to dress it up in like a hyper literal taking the metaphor to the extreme thing. I'm just going to write it exactly as it is. And that was different for me, because like usually I have an instant thought process when I see something and my brain instantly goes into like joke mode, and it's like, oh, a person thought this. That's a really weird thing to think. I'm going to just take an entire 20 pages and just make this joke for 20 pages. But this one was pretty much like, nope, this is exactly what's going on right now. Especially because at the other point I wrote this is when they started doing like the curfews for the protest and all that. And so there was one weird point, I think, when I was in Manhattan or somewhere in Queens. And it was just this notification I got on my phone of like, it's almost 8 o'clock. Like, it was one of those moments where you can't dress that up as anything. You can't hyper literal pretend it's something else. Like, there is no, oh, this is a metaphor for the dystopian. This is the dystopian thing right now. Like, it is. There is no metaphor. There's no nothing. This is the dystopia.
Yeah.
And yeah, everything feels so otherworldly already, even though it's real life. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like that part where my brain decided it's like, no, this is all of our nightmares. Exactly.
So just out of curiosity, what are some different works that you find yourself, whether it was when you were a kid or maybe now that you've been inspired by, like books, plays, or maybe like a movie, TV shows you've been watching, anything kind of spark inspiration?
There is the show The Good Place. Malibu's Most Wanted. Static Shock. I would say definitely a lot of music, a lot of rap music. Basically, most everything by Outkast. I don't know. It's something about music for some reason, because, like, especially rap music in particular, there's just this habit of using language in a way where, like, you can reach conclusion. And some songs, you know, they'll go and they'll do this chain, but it's, I found that listening to it a lot has helped me do this chain sequence of thought where I just connect thoughts to each other, and it's just like, okay, playing Game Boy, video games.
Yeah, levels. Let it flow.
Most of the evolution of language I find exists in those like poetic or lyrical structures that I find isn't quite anywhere else.
Yeah, for things to flow, but then like reference what you came before it, and like, yeah, the poetic quality of it. And then also just thinking, sorry, like Outkast shout out, but like there's something like intergalactic or otherworldly about the sound or the approach, but still very much grounded in real life. So that's interesting that like just having what you spoke of with the whole like sci-fi element and playing with something sometimes through metaphor, but then also like sometimes like with this play, kind of, no, let's ground it in this reality. If Trey's Broadcast had a soundtrack, could you like name a few things you think would be on it?
There'd definitely be like some No Name. There'd be some Run the Jewels on it. Definitely, like, there'd be some Kendrick Lamar on it.
I can see a little sprinkle of like Mos Def in there.
Yeah, there'd be some Mos Def, some Rhapsody, some Tierra Whack.
Nice. That'd be nice. Cool. I'd listen to that soundtrack.
I'd listen to it, yeah. So, do you have any funny or embarrassing theater moments that you've experienced, whether it be something of your writing?
Share your most painful moments in theater. Go.
Exactly.
Man, I'm trying to figure out which one to pick because I have so many. I have so many moments. One that sticks out, that always sticks out in particular, is when I was in high school, we did the musical Clue, and at the time, like, I was very much like a freshman in high school, like, I had not experienced like a relationship or having a girlfriend at all or any of that, and so during this particular moment, my first kiss was in this musical in particular, with the Miss Peacock character, because I was playing Colonel Mustard. And right at the time when it's like, okay, so we got to practice this, let's go, I realized that I get really subconscious about the fact that I think my lips are dry, because I'm also like the kid who is like, I'm going to have hand sanitizer and like breath mints and lotion and like all this stuff. And then I realized I didn't carry chapstick with myself. And I was like, really? Really, you got all the stuff
prepared for everything.
Sad, man. And so at some point, like, someone just lends me some and they're just like, here, like, you know. And so me being embarrassing and a freshman in high school goes, thank you. And I get this giant glob of it, like, way too much. And I'm just like, okay, let me just, like, just put it on my lips, because I'm just like, okay, I'm ready. It's that one. There's also, of course, my sophomore year, which is the even worse one. During our preview show, one of my friends, for one reason or another, does not have his cue. And so during this particular scene, we're like at a point where I'm supposed to be like seducing this main character's wife, or attempting to, and we're having this whole moment where I'm just ever so slightly edging closer, and like it's Moon Over Buffalo, and it's like I'm Richard and the woman is Charlotte, and it's just like, oh, Richard, Charlotte, Charlotte. And then there's a point where I'm close, and my director at this point is like, okay, if it gets to that point and he doesn't show up, you have to kiss her. That's just what it's going to have to be. You're going to have to kiss. That's what it's going to be, because that's where it's going. And so I'm like, oh, crap, this is what's going to happen. All right, I am not ready. And neither is she, because she straight up does this Matrix lean back, full on kneeling. Oh, no. And my brain, not being ready to improvise or not knowing how to improvise at all, goes from a high-class, upscale, smart lawyer to weird jazz musician. I'm just like, come on, baby, you don't want to kiss me a little bit? Come on.
She's like doing a backbend. Like,
it's
just like,
exactly. It's one of those moments that I laugh about. I'm also like, oh, my God.
That's funny.
Lord, that's so bad.
Well, thank you for sharing your pain. Yes. For our benefit. Yes. Finally, before we wrap up, can you tell us where you're based and what may be up next for you, and how folks can kind of keep up with what you're doing?
I am currently based in New York City. I have another play coming out titled The Substitute with this company, Stand By for Places, as well as I am currently working on this full-length play titled V from Vitality. Both of them very different from Trey's broadcast. The Substitute's pretty much like this teacher comes in to teach racism to the class, and then, you know, it turns out that they are, in fact, some otherworldly being that is actually testing to see if they should destroy humanity or not.
Interesting. Yes, I remember you were working on this draft last year, too. You sent it over to me. I remember reading
Yeah,
it.
I initially wrote that from this one thing I watched where this one actor had said, this so-and-so can't be racist because they kissed this black woman in this movie. And my brain was just like, is there just a school people go to learn to say the same racist stuff? And so I ended up just writing this entire joke from that thing of like, yes, this is the transitive property of the black friend. Basically, what you have here is...
Interesting, yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
And then what's the other one? V for Vitality?
V from Vitality is, yeah, it's about a company that sells drinks, and this one woman who's just kind of down in her luck just joins them because she's having a hard time quitting her current crappy paying job. And so she's just like, oh, I guess I'll join this random multi-level marketing thing that's based on way too many things in my actual life. Mm. Which parts of those are true, you will not know.
Okay, interesting.
It's basically my version of Two Truths and a Lie, or Taboo.
Nice. Both solid games for game night.
Yes.
And how can folks stay in touch with you or keep up with what you're doing?
Well, there's Twitter and there's Instagram. Okay. Those are my two main hangouts at the moment.
Mm-hmm. What's your handle?
At Delocethism on Twitter, which is just an anagram of my name.
Okay.
And then Leotis Smith, which is my Instagram handle, which I am working on getting better at Instagram.
Yeah, you're live on Twitter, man. I see you're but Instagram, you gotta yeah. Share some pictures, you know what I'm saying?
I'm working on getting better at taking pictures in my adult life. I used to do it more in my adolescence. Mm-hmm. You know, in high school, I was like taking pictures and taking dumb photos of myself, being like, yep, this is cringy, but I have no regrets. I still got photos up on Facebook that I'm like, yeah, I took this. I am never taking it down. You will know how dumb I was.
That's right. It's an evolution, man. It's the evolution of Leo. The Journey. Yeah, like that sounds like an album right there. Well, cool, man. We were so excited to do Trey's broadcast. We've gotten a lot of great response from it so far. And like, it's unfortunately that these stories have to be told in general, but if we don't tell them, then we won't make change. And that's what this play is all about, and I appreciate that. So, yeah, man. Thanks again for stepping into this interview with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. All right. Have a good one.
You as well.